Welcome to Trillo Talk. This is a podcast dedicated to topics that we think are important to the profession of medical writing. And our goal is to bring topical issues to the forefront and hopefully spark conversations in the wider domain about these issues. This is Julia Frajanik-Klaproth.
And this is Barry Dries.
In this session of Trillo Talk, Barry and I are going to field questions that have been sent to us by medical writers from all over the world. In fact, we get so many questions on a regular basis that we've sorted these into topics, and we're planning to run separate Trillo Talk sessions devoted to specific topics and aimed at writers of different levels. So today, we're going to focus on questions about clinical study reports and data reporting and analysis. The level of the questions we will address today is really for writers who have little experience writing CSRs and or handling the reporting of endpoints in studies, but we think there might be some interesting information in here for people at all levels. So if CSRs and data reporting is something you're interested in, keep listening. So the first question is, what is the difference between a synoptic CSR and an abbreviated CSR? And that is a very good question. It's also a very common question. And the reason for that is those two types of CSRs really are in a bit of a gray zone. There isn't a really clear line between when to have a synoptic CSR and abbreviated CSR, or at least it might seem like that at first glance. But I think to understand those two types of CSRs, it would be good to step back a little bit and take a look at all three versions of CSRs that are defined, certainly according to the FDA guidance. And it begins with a full CSR. That is a report that includes data on everything that was done in the study, and it's going to provide data that are needed to support the efficacy of the drug and will ultimately be included in a label. So if you think about using these CSRs in a dossier, your full CSR is a CSR that has data in it that's going to ultimately be used in your label to support the efficacy. Now, an abbreviated CSR is a condensed version of a CSR that is generally written when the efficacy either wasn't there, you didn't see efficacy in the study, or it might be a study that was run on an indication that isn't being applied for your submission, so you don't need that data in your label. And so you'll present some of the efficacy data, but it's really a summarized version of the efficacy data. So you're going to have in that study report, this is an abbreviated study report, a full set of all your safety data with the gory details, with the tables, and you're going to talk about all of it. You'll also have, of course, all your demographics and everything, but you'll have a reduced or summarized version of your efficacy. A synoptic CSR takes it down a notch further. So this is the smallest and most condensed version of a CSR. And really, generally, you won't have any efficacy data in this report. And you're probably not even going to have any tables or figures for your safety. You're just going to have a very high level summary of your safety data. Does that make sense to you, Barry?
It does, but I would add two little caveats and mm-hmm. comments. Mm-hmm. The first is, of course, when can I do these? And this involves a trap. Many people, the efficacy doesn't really work the way they'd hoped. So they think, well, I'm just going to write an abbreviated CSR. You actually have to have a reason why you're not really going to report efficacy, like the assay wasn't what you thought, or you didn't get the people enough reporting or something like this. You can't just say, I didn't like the results, so I'm going to do an abbreviated CSR. You do have to do a full CSR if your drug didn't work, because the authorities, of course, want to see that.
Well, absolutely. But it has to do, so I'm looking at the FDA guidance right now, and what they say is abbreviated reports should be submitted for studies that are not intended to contribute to the evaluation of product effectiveness or provide definitive information on clinical pharmacology, but about which the reviewer needs sufficient information to determine that the study results do not in fact cast doubt on the effectiveness claims or the description of the clip. So that's why, if, like you said, if you get bad efficacy, you can't go, oh, well, we just won't talk about the efficacy in this one. No, you have to talk about it.
Good, yeah.
Those cases where the efficacy for this study isn't relevant to the label claim you're trying to make. You know, it's, I don't know, I can't think of a good example.
A totally different indication when
Different indication, exactly. Then you can provide a summary of the efficacy, which shows the reviewer what efficacy you had, but makes it absolutely clear it's not in any way relevant, and it's not going to cast doubt on the efficacy you got for the label you're trying to get.
Good. Or that's an important point, and it's good to make. And with the synoptic, from my experience, mostly they're done on studies that were interrupted for some reason, and you have only a small number. And so that's why you can get away with what's essentially a glorified synopsis, because it's not enough patients to really say much about anything. So I saw a synoptic CSR for 500 patients. I would be wondering what was going on there. The ones I see are usually a small number.
Yeah. I agree. And one of the things that they make the distinction with is also in a synoptic CSR, you typically won't actually put any tables in it at all.
Right.
You'll just have brief summaries of the information. Whereas an abbreviated CSR, certainly for the safety, it's going to have the full-fledged safety with all the normal tables. And yeah, I totally agree with you. Can you please explain the difference between the primary and secondary analyses and statistical power?
Okay, that's
great. Want to take that one?
Oh, sorry. Yes, I was so eager I jumped in. Yes, I think that's a great question because I think this is widely misunderstood, and it is important to understand it because it's really the essence of why you're doing the study and how you're doing the study. According to the Declaration of Helsinki, which is an agreement everyone signed back in the 1970s or 80s or something like this, about the proper running of clinical trials, it says you must not have too few patients to make a proper conclusion, and you must not have too many patients because you don't want to be exposing humans to risk with an unapproved drug for no reason, which means you have to be like Goldilocks and get the exact right amount. And how do you do that? Well, there's a section in ICH for the CSR talk that's called the sample size calculation. And without going into all the details that you'd kind of need a stats course for, you need to know the variable, in other words, like fasting blood glucose or overall survival. You need to know the clinically relevant difference for patients. That's where a lot of people get hung up, because how much is a clinically relevant difference? That could be a separate talk here, is how you figure that out.
Exactly. We'll have a podcast on that one day.
Exactly. And then you need to know what kind of statistical testing and all that. Then you can calculate how many subjects you need to actually show that. What that means is that is what you have statistical power to show that. But if you think about it, if you look at something different, like patient satisfaction or fever or something else, it might be very different because the clinically relevant difference for patients would be very different. So you do that, and the variable and the analysis that you have made your sample size calculation tells you whether you need 20 patients or 300. And that is then your primary analysis. And that is what your study is powered for. Secondary, on the other hand, is in theory, statistically anyway, everything else. There are an issue, which we'll get to in a minute, about different kinds of secondary and exploratory and so on. But statistically anyway, there's no real difference there. So primary is what you have done your sample size calculation for, and it gives you the statistical power for that analysis. Secondary is other things you're looking at.
Mm-hmm. Which the study wasn't designed to give you statistical power to answer.
Not only that, it doesn't give you. So right. If you do statistics exactly. on those other things, they're not really valid in that same way. And what you often face with secondary is you get a statistically significant result that is not clinically relevant. That should never happen with primary if you've done it correctly, because it's part of the calculation. So assuming you came up with a good clinically relevant difference, it will be inherent in your statistical significance for your primary analysis.
Okay, well, I think that actually fits nicely with another question we got, which is, what is the difference between key secondary, and exploratory efficacy variables, and how do you present them in the results section?
Okay, so some of you have been thinking, and I kind of touched on it already, that's primary, fine. What's going on with secondary? And in fact, as the questioner asked, sometimes you see key secondary, other secondary, exploratory. Believe it or not, I've seen tertiary. I've seen other things.
Absolutely.
Statistically speaking, there is no difference between any of those. However, that tends to be used by people to indicate how much weight they're going to give it and what they're going to say about it. My experience is key secondary tend to be variables that look at the same kind of variable that you looked at for primary. So let's say your primary analysis is patient response on day 10. You might do a secondary analysis on day 5. It's still looking at the same thing. It's just at a different time. No, your study's not statistically powered for that, but you might think, well, you know, if 10 is kind of interesting, it might be interesting to see what it was at day 5. So it's kind of a test thing to see. That would tend to be something like a secondary. Other secondaries would be things that are not so directly related, like let's say at the same study, you're also looking for the presence of bacteria in the urine or sensitivity to pain, anything like that. Once you get to exploratory, those are really out there, and those tend to be things like pharmacogenomics. You're taking DNA samples from people and seeing how it compares with response. Pharmacoeconomics, quality of life, those things tend to be more exploratory because they're not really related to the secondary at all, really. I mean, of course, if you get better, you should have positive outcomes in many of these things.
And they tend to be a lot more academic and things that you're more likely to talk about in a manuscript later on, but not necessarily in your dossier.
What Julia means is it's fishing expedition. You know, and those are things, and I say that, you know, and I mean it as a bit of a joke, but on the other hand, you're going out and looking for things and seeing if there's anything interesting out there that maybe you would use in future studies. So how people treat exploratory is, unless they find something really exciting, they tend to kind of shove it at the back of the results and say, we did this stuff. If they find something really exciting, they bring it up, but of course, it's still nowhere near as important as primary. So you always do primary first. Then with secondary, if you have key secondary, you'll probably do all of those.
Yes.
Other secondary, you may summarize them. You're probably not going to give the results one by one. And then exploratory, I know many companies that simply have a paragraph saying, we also looked at this stuff. Here's where the tables are.
Exactly. In fact, I encourage teams to do that, particularly when they have quite a few exploratory analyses and they're really not telling you anything new. Or sometimes anything at all. I mean, if it's not telling you anything at all, that's also worth saying, but you don't need to go through each one of those tables in gory detail and talk about them over and over and over again. It's perfectly sufficient just to summarize in one sentence, this is what we think these are telling us, go look at them yourself.
Yeah, and this is a great place to introduce one of my favorite quotes by an FDA reviewer who said, we often don't get good documents. Often it reads like this, in 1906, there was a goat, then there was a chicken, then there was a cow, and after 22 pages, you get to something interesting, end quote. And I think we as medical writers have a responsibility to put the most interesting stuff first. That's why primary should always be first, followed by key secondary, exploratory, if you have those.
Yep, totally agree. Cool. Okay, well, I hope that sufficiently answered the question. Let's take a look at the next one. Okay, in a CSR, what is the exact purpose of the shell version prior to having any results? Clients seem to have very different expectations. Indeed, they do. I'll take a stab at this one to start. I think to talk about Shell reports, we need to think about where they came from. So Barry and I are old enough to have been working in the industry since before Shell reports were written. And that means when we started writing study reports back in the dark ages, people literally just sat down one day and they would take the protocol and the things they had, generally around the same time that they were getting the data, and it would take them 2 to 3 weeks to write up the full first draft. Then some clever person realized, well, you know, you could start writing up the method section before the data were there. Why don't we do that so that after the data come, you don't have to spend any time writing the methods? That's already done. That's a really good idea, and it's a great way to save some time. And so that was sort of the birth child of a shell, the idea being that before the data get there, you sit down, you write all of the methods. And then that evolved into saying, well, since we're doing that, why don't we get the team to think a little bit about what we're going to do with the results once they get there? And it started with a simple outline, maybe mapping out what kind of tables you think you might put in there, or something like that. And that was really intended just to get the team to pull their thoughts together, again, before the real data came. That was also a good idea. Unfortunately, what happened next was a bit of a runaway evolution where people thought, oh, we're going to continue this. And they began to write mock reports, where instead of just making an outline with maybe a few bullets of the key ideas they're hoping to have, they started actually writing real text around fake or dummy data that were being generated. And teams began to actually even debate the wording and meaning of the dummy data that was being presented. This was where the process kind of moved into the nonsensical. And so that's really what a shell is there for. In the ideal world, you use the time before your data come in to get as much done on the report as possible, get the team to review it, get it all locked down. And then, theoretically, when the data come in, nobody looks at those lockdown sections anymore. They just focus on writing the results with the fresh data and filling in the outline that you've built. So that's sort of the purpose of the shell and the reason why different teams want different things. It's because some of them go the real purist, where we just basically get an outline. Some of them go a little bit more, where they fill in some ideas of messaging, and some go all the way out on the limb with writing up mock data about dummy data. I think an interesting thing that has come to pass with the development of AI tools is shells probably aren't going to be needed anymore. The reason for that is we developed the idea of writing these shells in order to save time, because in the olden days, the writers would sit down and it would take them 2 to 3 weeks to get a first draft of the report out to the rest of the team before they could even start to think about it. If you have an AI tool that can generate a first draft of the full CSR within minutes, then the speed of producing that report and getting it out to your team for review stops being an issue. And in fact, since we know that in theory, people aren't supposed to go and reread the sections that have been locked down, they do. So it's possible, if you're using an AI tool, that you can just get the whole first draft with everything in it that you need, give it to your team a day after the data is available, basically. And they can now use that time to read the whole document in one go. It could remove a lot of redundancies. And just imagine a world in which all those subject matter experts and the reviewers don't have to spend weeks or sometimes even months ahead of getting the data, reviewing multiple drafts of these mock reports.
I love what you're saying about the AI tool, and I have am sort of infamous for saying now is maybe one of the best times to be a medical writer because the AI tool, and I'm going to use a little visual aid here, has absolved us of having to use this handy little item.
Which is a highlighter.
Which is a highlighter.
On audio
going through pages and pages and tables of highlighting things and trying to sort it and organize it. I do want to just say one thing about a mock report. It can sound very tempting to teams if they say, let's write the text as if we know the results. Yep. And then if the results match, we're already done. And for safety, it's classic because you say there were no differences in adverse events between our drug and placebo. Cool. That's what we'd all hope for, of course. The problem is it's a bit of a psychological thing. Once you start seeing text there, you begin to think it's based on the numbers. And it's very easy, maybe not in every single case, but inevitably in a couple of cases, you'll just blow over that text thinking, right, it describes what's in the table. And it doesn't. It was made up to fit there. There's a famous quote in Sherlock Holmes about never theorize without facts. You make your theory, then you twist and adjust the facts to suit the theory rather than what you should be doing, which is adjust your theory to fit the facts. And I think that's the big, big danger in mock reports and why I am not a fan at all. I did a few in the early days, but I quickly got my fingers burned and decided this was not a good idea. And that's why the brilliance of the AI thing is so...
Yes.
So strong is that it will not do that. It will generate and give you bullet points and so on of what all the important things are. And then you can just adjust that into text.
Exactly. Exactly. Okay. Well, good. I think this is probably a good place to stop for today. A little bit of a soundbite with some hopefully helpful tips. It was good talking to you, Barry. I'm looking forward to our next session.
Thank you. Indeed. Indeed. So see you then.
Okay. Take care. So thank you for listening to Trilotalk today. If you enjoyed it, please come back and listen to us again. If you have feedback on this or any of our sessions, we would love to hear it. In addition, if you have ideas for future topics that you'd like us to cover, particularly something you think the community should be talking about, let us know. We would like this to be an ongoing conversation with medical writers at large, and you can send us comments on our Twitter feed or on our LinkedIn page. Just a reminder, you can find all our episodes of the Trilotalk podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and trilogywriting.com/Trilotalk. Have a good rest of your day.